P2P Connects Us podcast. I'm your host, John Light, and on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the Immortal Pirate Bay's revival, Project Maelstrom and the new internets, OK Turtles relaunch and the Blockchain ID project, and last, but certainly not least, Richard Myers joins the show to talk about the BitSquare P2P Bitcoin exchange. Hello, 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 and welcome once again to episode 10 of the P2P Connects Us podcast. This past week, 96,253.56 LTB coin were given away to Patreon patrons who shared their receipt and counter wallet address. Thanks to your support, I have achieved my first goal of $5 in pledges per episode on Patreon. Thank you so much to everyone who's helped make this happen. If just one more listener pledges $1 per episode, I will hit my next goal of $25 in pledges per episode. And if 75 more listeners pledge $1 after that, I will achieve my goal of $100 in pledges per episode. Can you help me get there? You can make a pledge and earn LTB coin in the process by going to patreon.com/p2pconnectsus, making a pledge of $1 or more, and sending me a screenshot of your receipt and a counter wallet address so I can include you in the weekly Patreon patron LTB coin giveaway. Thanks again to everyone who has pledged on Patreon and tipped me with bitcoins. It really means a lot to me. P2P Connects Us is looking for content creators. I'm paying 50,000 LTB coin for high-quality videos, 25,000 LTB coin for audio content, and 15,000 LTB coin for written articles. All work published will be released under a copyleft license so that it's free to remix and redistribute as long as any derivatives or copies are also released copyleft. If you're interested in sharing your own perspectives on peer-to-peer philosophy, technology, and culture, please contact me through the contact page on my website at p2pconnects.us. There's also a 30,000 LTB coin bounty up for grabs for the first person to transcribe the interview at the end of each P2P Connects Us episode. To stake your claim in an interview transcription, go to the official P2P Connects Us thread in the Listener's Lounge section of the forums on letstalkbitcoin.com and add a post letting people know which interview you want to transcribe. First come, first serve, but if you transcribe the interview in an Etherpad document and link to it in the forum thread, you can also work with a partner to figure out how to split the bounty and collaborate with them to transcribe the interview together. Visit the official P2P Connects Us thread in the Let's Talk Bitcoin forum for all the details. You can follow P2P Connects Us on Twitter and SoundCloud, subscribe to the P2P Connects Us YouTube channel, and sign up for email alerts each time new content is posted on the P2P Connects Us blog by entering your email address in the sign-up form at p2pconnects.us. With those announcements out of the way, let's move on to the news. A month and a half after the December 9th raid, which seized servers and took down the infamous Pirate Bay file sharing website, the pirates are back again, albeit with a slimmed down version of their website. Just days before the relaunch of PirateBay.se, former staffers told the news site Torrent Freak that they were being denied access from the new site so that it would be easier to maintain, warning that the lack of moderation could lead to spam and malicious torrent files being uploaded. Instead, the former Pirate Bay staffers would be launching their own full moderated website using a data backup they copied before the raid. Internal drama notwithstanding, it appears that there has been minimal data loss since the raid on the original Pirate Bay website, with users still being able to log in to their old accounts and most of the torrent files being accounted for. Shortly before the relaunch of the Pirate Bay, ISO Hunt, The core developers of the old Pirate Bay project mentioned in episode 8 of this podcast announced a $100,000 giveaway contest for contributors to the old Pirate Bay website, including developers who contribute to the open source project and moderators and uploaders who help maintain the website. Interestingly enough, old Pirate Bay still has the top spot when you search for Pirate Bay on most major search engines. ISO Hunt said that they would keep Old Pirate Bay alive even if the original site came back online, so we'll see whether or not they'll keep the $100,000 giveaway going when they upgrade the site in March. BitTorrent Inc., developers of the peer-to-peer BitTorrent file sharing protocol, have announced invite-only access to Project Maelstrom, a project that, quote, started with a simple question. What if more of the web worked the way BitTorrent does? Unquote. Project Maelstrom is a modified version of the Google Chrome browser which can load websites using BitTorrent files, making websites resistant to denial of service attacks and helping popular websites load faster the same way that popular torrent files download faster when more peers are sharing the files. This is similar to the as-yet-unreleased browser originally announced by the developers of the Pirate Bay back in 2014. A spokesperson for the Pirate Bay said back then, quote, "The goal is to create a browser-like client to circumvent censorship, including domain blocking, domain confiscation, and IP blocking. This will be accomplished by sharing all of a site's indexed data as peer-to-peer downloadable packages that are then browsed and rendered locally. It's basically a browser-like app that uses WebKit to render pages and BitTorrent to download the content while storing everything locally." Unquote. MadeSafe, whose developer Evangelist Paige Peterson was recently featured in episode 6 of this podcast, is working on a similar project, though their applications go beyond just web browsing to include messaging, asset exchanges, marketplaces, and more. Another open source project called ZeroNet also released an early version of similar software, which lets people create and browse websites using a combination of BitTorrent and Bitcoin technology. It's incredibly exciting to see so many smart developers tackling the problem of censorship on the web using peer-to-peer technology, and highlights how powerful peer-to-peer can be in the right hands. No matter which version of this technology ends up gaining the biggest network effect, either way, it's all making the world a better place. Speaking of making the world a better place, the OK Turtles Foundation has launched a new website redesign at okturtles.org with help from web designer Will Stanley, developer and OK Turtles co-founder Greg Slipak, and yours truly. The foundation is now accepting Bitcoin and credit card donations on the website at okturtles.org/donate. Anything you can send our way to help support our mission of securing the internet with blockchain technology is greatly appreciated. There's also new DNS chain documentation on the GitHub page thanks to the hard work of Mike Ward. OK Turtles is also happy to announce the Blockchain ID project, which extends the Open Name peer-to-peer identity protocol to offer a new, convenient way to log into websites using an open name identity. You can learn more about DNS chain and peer-to-peer blockchain-based identity by listening to my interview with OK Turtles co-founder and DNS chain core developer Greg Slipak in episode 5 of P2P Connects Us. It's time for the magic word. The magic word for today's episode is pirate. That's P-I-R-A-T-E. Pirate. You can redeem the magic word on letstalkbitcoin.com for your share of the weekly LTB coin distribution, and you can learn more about LTB coin at ltbcoin.com. I would like to welcome to episode 10 of the P2P Connects Us podcast, Richard Myers of BitSquare. Richard, thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks, John.
Richard, what does peer-to-peer mean to you?
For us, peer-to-peer is no central point of failure or no single point of failure. It's decentralized. It's sort of what we think is the future, really, the future of community-owned applications, community-owned networks.
We tend to agree with that perspective here at P2P ConnectSys. So what is BitSquare?
BitSquare is what we think is the next evolution of the interface between Bitcoin, or pretty much any cryptocurrency, and the legacy banking system. There's currently no good alternative for that, getting in and out of Bitcoin from national currencies. And that's what we hope to provide. And we think it's very timely right now because you've seen the hacks, Mt. Gox, of course, being the biggest of those. But not just hacks, but also attacks on Bitcoin in some ways when you start seeing Coinbase doing transaction tracing, coin tracing. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what motivates us. And what we're doing is basically doing something that Bitcoin has enabled for a long time, but nobody's actually taken advantage of. In some ways, we're not inventing something new. We're just trying to fully realize what Bitcoin has sort of made possible since the beginning, practically.
What is the experience like for people using the software?
It's going to be a little different than maybe what they expect. You're not going to necessarily go to a web page to do your trading. You're going to download an application, and that application will put you on the P2P network to do your exchange. After that, it's going to be a little bit like perhaps local Bitcoins. If any of your listeners are familiar with that, you're going to either place an ad to buy or sell Bitcoin, or you're going to accept an ad, take an offer to buy or sell Bitcoin. But then after that, the trade is just mediated by the software, and it's conducted between those two people directly. So let's say I'm buying Bitcoin and I take an ad, then I'm going to receive via an encrypted message the banking details of that person and an assurance that they have locked their Bitcoin into a multi-sig address. That's a little behind the scenes, but what it means is that you can be assured that the Bitcoin are waiting for you and they can't be taken back by the seller until you've sent your cash, you've sent your national currency in whatever way you've both agreed. And then that person, when they see it, for instance, you have a bank account, you'll send the money to that bank account or in whatever way you guys have decided. And then he or she will release the Bitcoin. And then you'll basically both confirm that is a successful trade and boom, you're done. What is interesting about that interaction is they're in the happy path, we say, you know, in the path where everybody is behaving properly. There is no third party involved. It's all mediated by the network and between two people. Now, of course, people aren't always trustworthy. You have to, especially when you're dealing with the legacy banking system, you always have to worry about the cash part of the transaction. The Bitcoin is fine, but the cash part, of course, is open to interpretation and you can get conflict there. So that's why there's a third party on this multi-sig address, the two traders, and then the third is an arbitrator that had been previously agreed to. That's the person that basically will help mediate the interaction between the two parties if there's a conflict. And it isn't always fraud. It could be somebody went on vacation or they lost their computer, you know, they dropped their computer. There are many things. So that's why there's really no automated way to handle that situation. You really need a third party. And then the key is just to make sure it isn't a single third party. In the case of like a local Bitcoins, the only third party is local Bitcoins. But that makes them a central point of attack, especially from a government, for instance. That's probably maybe some of your listeners have heard about what's happened in Germany, where they basically pulled out of the German market because there was so much ambiguity about the regulation. We think we avoid that by basically taking away that central party.
There's a lot of stuff to go over there, but just on that point, is there like a marketplace for arbitrators themselves then, where people can find a list of arbitrators, and can anyone be an arbitrator in that case?
Yeah, I mean, that's key to the whole idea of being decentralized. Anybody can become an arbitrator. Now, you probably will have different levels of privacy because theoretically you could have a sort of an anonymous arbitrator. But I think for there to be a real market, people are going to favor arbitrators that are more publicly known. Mm-hmm. But there'll be a constellation of them. And the way we're sort of speccing out this trade protocol, each person who's buying or selling will pick the arbitrators, a pool of arbitrators. They'll sort of create their own pool of arbitrators. And then when the match is made, you'll just look for an overlap in the arbitrators that both sides agree on. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be some deterministic random way to pick which one. So mm-hmm. there are certain exploits if it was always going to be a certain one.
Yeah. I've heard of a technique where each party picks an arbitrator and then those two arbitrators decide between themselves an arbitrator.
Oh, yeah. That's actually a clever way to do it, too. Some of that arbitration picking, we have it specced out in our white paper, but we do expect, you know, experience will help guide us to really refine that part of it.
Your team put together a pretty comprehensive risk analysis document outlining
many of the things that could go wrong when people use the software, which is something I don't really see very often in many open source projects or software in general. So what are some of the risks that people should be aware of when they're using BitSquare?
Well, that was originally put together by Manfred Carrer, who's our founder and really the driving force behind this project. When you're dealing with money, it is important to really look through these cases, and many of the risks that you have to look out for are certainly not unique to a BitSquare system. But mm-hmm. I mean, an example is chargebacks. That's the one that is most often cited as a problem with a peer-to-peer financial exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really very specific to the national jurisdiction you're into. Some jurisdictions, like the United States, is probably one of the, it's usually phrased as most consumer-friendly. People can claw back their money and almost no questions asked if you're using a credit card or if you're using PayPal
mm-hmm.
or some similar thing. It's actually kind of hard in the U.S. That's why I think in the U.S. most people currently, at least from my last look on local Bitcoins, use, like, for instance, cash in a bank is one way to do it, to get around that problem of chargeback, you know, later in the process. So chargeback, just to explain, is just when the money gets transferred from one bank to the other, and then the person goes to their bank a week later, a month later, and says, I take that back, or I, you know, my bank account was hacked, or they make up some story.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately, in the worst case scenario, you'd actually have to go to small claims court to get that money back. So as much as possible, we want to avoid those scenarios by just not supporting payment systems, the legacy systems that allow chargeback. And in other national jurisdictions, I mean, this is really an international project, that is less of a problem. So
in that case, then, what payment options do you recommend for people who are using BitSquare?
We're going to do something similar to what local Bitcoins did, where we're going to compile a table of known successful payment systems.
Okay.
And best practices. And some of this will be for the community to decide too. The other protection is really just to keep the amounts low at first. We're going to definitely not scale this up amount-wise very fast until we've been able to really get a good handle on what works and what doesn't from that regard. Because anybody who's, for instance, actually hacked into somebody's bank account, they're not looking to make $20 or $100. They're really looking to cash the whole thing out, you know, thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. So as long as we keep the amounts low while we're figuring out the chargeback landscape in each jurisdiction, then I think that will help give us some heads up on what works and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping the amounts low, that's one way. The other way that we deal with this is there's something called a Sybil attack. I'm not sure how familiar people are with that, but the idea is that in any kind of distributed peer-to-peer system, you can end up with a lot of fake user accounts, you know, people who create 1,000 user accounts. They could do something that steals somebody's money, or they could be, you know, dishonest in some way, and then just go to the next account. So one way we try to prevent Sybil attacks, people creating lots of sort of bogus accounts, is there's a concept of a registration, but it isn't like a centralized registration process. It's more of a what we call like a blind hash of your payment details. So that means that you hash your name and your payment account, and that's what you register with some amount of Bitcoin as sort of a guarantee that you don't just do this a million times.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you do, for instance, do something that violates the trade protocol, you don't respond to the arbitrator, or you do something more against the system, then that will invalidate that registration. And to get another registration, you would have to open a new bank account. And there's really a finite, in any jurisdiction, going to be a finite number of banks. And if you do that a lot anyway, it's going to certainly put you under the microscope from a government standpoint. So really just as it's not the only defense we have, but it's a way to just prevent arbitrary large number of accounts being, registration being made.
The details that people register could just be like fake, right?
They could, but those registration details are going to be unblinded to the person you trade with. So if you don't give your, that's why it's your payment details.
Oh, it's unblinded after. Okay.
Yeah, but only between the trading parties. So
right.
That's key. So even though it's, you could say that there's a little bit of a leak of privacy, it's what's different about this from a privacy standpoint is that there's no way to do sort of mass surveillance. I mean, everybody who trades will have some leaking of their privacy as a necessary way to transfer their funds through the legacy banking system.
Uh-huh.
But there will be no way from a privacy standpoint to monitor. There won't be a central place to subpoena, for instance, and say, give me all your trade data or give me all your user base.
Yeah, So if someone does, say, use a bank account to register, would they be able to use more private payment methods afterwards, like cash or money orders? Because, like, some people in general just have concern with giving up bank details because there's bank fraud and things that can happen. Just being able to make ACH requests out of an account, you know, just knowing the account number. So.
No, you're right. And I think, for instance, taking the United States as an example, I would expect you to see less bank-to-bank transfer registrations and more cash-in-bank or money order kind of registrations. And if it's a money order registration, then it is a little less prone to fraud in some ways than it would be, because, you know, there's a different way to confirm that. You wouldn't have to confirm it with a bank account.
Mm-hmm.
In Sweden, where I'm living now, they have a way where you can, it's a bit like Dwolla perhaps, where you can actually register a phone number and do just basically send money to a phone number. And that, you know, that doesn't leak quite the same amount of privacy that way either.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So I guess all of those kinds of details for end users, is that available now or will it be available in the near future?
We're still in alpha. So we're in a 0.1 alpha. Manfred started the project in March and brought most of us on in the summer. So he's basically self-funded the 0.1 release, which is a alpha. You can download it now in Windows, on Mac or Linux, and run it. But it's, like I said, it's only an alpha. It's running on the testnet, and we're now actually crowdfunding for the next round. I'll get into that later. What isn't implemented, for instance, is the arbitration isn't implemented.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically just putting in offers on the distributed network and locking up some testnet coins in a multi-sig address. But you can kind of get a flavor for it. And I do encourage people to just download it, or you can go on GitHub if you want to build it yourself, look through the code.
Okay. So is that 2 of 2 multi-sig? Or?
It's 2 of 3 because the third is your arbitrator. But, I mean, right now, right, there's just a fixed arbitrator. The arbitration isn't implemented. It's designed, but it isn't turned on yet. So.
Oh, when you say fixed, so is that someone at the project who's kind of taking on that role right now?
Yeah. I mean, in our testing, we're not testing arbitration. We're just testing the basic distributed order book.
Sure.
But that's coming up in the next couple of releases, is to get that turned on for the arbitration.
Okay. So in general, then, I guess, what is the technology that's being used to make all of this possible?
Yeah, that's a good question. From a Bitcoin standpoint, it's pretty straightforward. It's multi-sig, 2 of 3 multi-sig. That's the wallet that holds the accounts that are being traded. From a P2P standpoint, we're using distributed hash tables, so DHT, the same technology used for BitTorrent. And then beyond that, it's just regular private key, public key encryption to transfer messages between people. We're actually using something called Tom P2P. So that's our underlying layer that runs the DHT.
Okay.
And that's a great project. For Bitcoin, we're using Bitcoin J, which is Mike Hearn's Bitcoin library. It's been really useful. And then, that's pretty much what we use for encryption as well.
Okay, cool. So when I think of distributed hash tables, like you mentioned, I think of BitTorrent. Is this software like BitTorrent where users have to be online at the same time for files to be shared through the network? Or is there any concept of asynchronous communication here?
In our 0.1 alpha, it has to be synchronous, but that's just a step in our milestones. The next version will have a idea of a permanence for that stuff. So if you think about it in the BitTorrent sense, normally you would have to be online, but you can replicate your order information. So there is a way to do this in an offline way, at least to have orders offline.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not currently implemented, but that's in our roadmap.
Okay, so how long do orders stay on the books for before they're invalid?
That right now, it's sort of until canceled. So you put an order up and can basically stay there until canceled.
Uh-huh.
But because this is running as an application on your computer, we certainly foresee alternatives to that. If you want to put it up for a certain amount of time, or you want to somehow monitor the market and do all those fancy things that people do. But this wouldn't really be a system for day traders. This is really for people who want to get in and out of Bitcoin in a sort of long-term sense.
Sure.
But there are ways. There are ways that, you know, somebody could use this if they were more a trader and less of a just investor.
So what other kinds of metadata is associated with the order? Like, is there any concepts of like location of the sellers, since maybe it makes more sense for me to trade with somebody in my own country than somewhere where international wires would be expensive or something like that?
Yeah, that's part of the metadata. So part of the metadata is the set of arbitrators you would agree to, but also the other one is the set of banking methods or payment methods that you would support. So you may support only a Swedish bank euro system or a U.S. postal money order. So you would, that would be a part of your metadata. And when you're, mm-hmm. when you're looking at your order book, it's going to filter it based on the criteria that you've previously set up. So even though the network is global and international, you're really going to just see a slice of that that filters what you're going to want to trade with.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned a little bit earlier that you kind of envision this system being used not just for Bitcoin, but other cryptocurrencies. And at the same time, this system kind of reminds me of Open Bazaar, which markets itself as a more general marketplace than just a Bitcoin exchange. Have you thought about expanding the functionality of your software so that people can offer to sell more than just dollars in exchange for Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, that's something we've talked about. We're really focused on getting out the basic crypto to national currency exchange. But of course, we like to dream about, you know, what we're going to do next. And I think altcoins of some sort is a possibility. It would be a lot easier in some ways than exchanging a national currency just because you've got blockchains to reference. Mm-hmm. And as far as Open Bazaar goes, we're very much inspired by the same idea as Open Bazaar. We're just taking a slightly different tact on that by focusing on currency over goods. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason we did that is because with goods, you sort of run into the eBay situation where arbitration becomes a lot more intensive. You know, did they ship you the good? It's not just did they ship it, it's, you know, was it broken? Was it what you asked for? So we didn't really want to get into that. We wanted to stay pretty focused on something where it's easily arbitrated. And part of the philosophy there is that when you have a very strong arbitration system that really can be done without a lot of ways to scam it, that you really can build the network that way and mm-hmm. people won't scam it, basically. Well-done arbitration should never really be invoked except for like when somebody goes on vacation accidentally or something. Pretty simple systems.
Yeah. So I guess in that case, I mean, so for people who want to prove that they, say, ship the goods, so to speak, and made the wire transfer, is that just as simple as showing an arbitrator like a receipt from the bank or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, this will be developed by the pool of arbitrators. I think a best practices will have to develop. But I think already, if you look on local Bitcoins, there are some pretty good best practices. And for somebody to fake a wire, you know, it may be possible, but there are, you know, you can call the bank, you can give a receipt number. There will have to be ways like that to really make arbitration deterministic. You don't want there to be a lot of interpretation.
It is best if it's just a binary, like, yes, it happened, no, it didn't kind of thing.
Right, right.
Yeah, so cool. So it's good to hear that you guys are staying focused on that because it seems like that's a really valuable niche, especially so it's not just like governments that local Bitcoins has to worry about. It's common hackers. Apparently they got hacked recently and user funds were stolen and malware was distributed to the users. And so that just goes to show you what kind of a risk central points of failures can represent to the users of these marketplaces.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. I mean, we really, you know, like the local Bitcoins guys. That's a good project and it's sad, but it's almost inevitable once you create these central points of attack and the monetary value goes up high enough, it just creates this huge incentive to be hacked. And it really is, I mean, if Target, a huge corporation, can't prevent their very critical credit card information from being hacked, then how can smaller companies prevent it? It's really not easy problem.
On that topic, do you know anything about the security practices of the developers? I know it's very early versions of the software, so maybe it hasn't gone through too much audits for bugs and the like yet, but it sounds like you're using pretty well-supported libraries for at least developing the Bitcoin portion and peer-to-peer portion of the software. But I mean, so are the releases signed? Are they distributed through, you know, at least SSL secured connections, stuff like that?
Yeah, we've got a pretty good system for doing that now, but we do plan on evolving that to be, you know, easy for people to check the signed releases. Mm-hmm. And that's what's up there now on their website is our signed releases. And as far as a security audit goes, that's in our roadmap to really reach out to the community and get some security audits. But part of what we're doing is, I mean, the big security from a Bitcoin standpoint is the fact that everybody has their own wallet, and when they do a trade, they create a multi-sig wallet. So the multi-sig aspect alone gives you some security.
Mm-hmm.
So even if one particular user had their computer completely compromised, the worst that the hacker could do with respect to their trade wallet, their multi-sig wallet, would be to approve a trade. So, you know, at worst, the hacker could make one trade go through. It isn't like there's a big pool of money there. And if they, you know, if a user does have a big pool of money, they're going to keep it in whatever offline wallet or whatever wallet they want. So there isn't even their own wallet. They're basically only trading. They're only transferring into the BitSquare system what they want to trade. So that also reduces the risk. But no, absolutely. We're going to reach out to and get as much auditing as we can. And that's also why we're a volunteer project, and we're open source, free open source software. And that's part of our, I think, a necessity for anything like this, is that it can be reviewed, the code can be reviewed. And we'll definitely, that's a high priority for us to get done as we get, especially right now we're on testnet, but as we start getting ready for a beta that's going to run on the mainnet, then that's a critical thing for us to do.
Excellent. So on that note, what are some near-term and long-term goals for BitSquare?
Sure. Well, I mean, near-term, we're getting ready for a 0.2 release, and this has some of what I mentioned before, the permanence of the offers, so people don't have to be online at the same time to look at the offers and to trade. Down the road, we have a roadmap. So if you go to bitsquare.io and look at the roadmap, you can see sort of our plan leading up to a 1.0 release, which we expect to have ready sometime in 2015. And, you know, that's going to take you through arbitration and improvements on that side of things. Obviously, we're really focused on 1.0. Long-term, I think, you know, you can see what we've certainly thought about, but we're not too focused on what happens after 1.0. Like I said, we can look at some things like altcoins, and putting this on a cell phone would be great, getting a mobile app. I mean, that's more like a long-term aspect for us.
Yeah, so you've mentioned the crowdfunding a couple times now. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about what your goals are there and you know, all the details associated with that?
Sure. Yeah, and I think it's sort of relevant for this talk because we're using Lighthouse, which is itself a peer-to-peer crowdfunding app. This is Kern's project. So we really thought philosophically and sort of from a design pattern standpoint, Lighthouse was very compatible with our project. And it's new, it's brand new, it just came out, but we really wanted to take a chance with it and support Mike, you know, by showing that this could be a way that you could fund distributed projects like ours, decentralized projects like ours. So we're basically have a crowdfunding campaign going to fund incremental releases. So we're not asking for a large sum to fund through the entire end of the project. We're hoping to sort of pioneer this idea of supporting projects, free open source projects, in an iterative way. So we're only asking for the funds to get us to our next release, so that we can create a tight loop between actually delivering and then asking for the next milestone funding and until we get to 1.0 on our roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
The current campaign runs till February 9th. We're asking for a total of 150 Bitcoin. We've already got some great pledges. I think we're about 26% of the way there. And I really encourage anybody who is interested in decentralized applications to look at Lighthouse. It's a really innovative project, and it's well worth the community's time to support. Mike created it to really support Bitcoin itself in core development, and I think he's really got something. It really seems like the right way to do it. It's a decentralized application, which means that nobody is holding the funds. It's all on the blockchain, basically. So that's very exciting for us, and we're happy to see that we've gotten some support. One of our more notable supporters has been Olivier Janssen, who also is a supporter of Mike Kern's Lighthouse project. He put up the bounty, $100,000 bounty, I believe it was, that Mike is getting some of to build Lighthouse.
Yeah, I've been using the Lighthouse software, just kind of playing around, importing files, creating projects and stuff like that. It's a really well done piece of software. And big props to Olivier for, you know, helping to fund that, and also for contributing some initial funding to your own Lighthouse project. And so where can people go to learn more about BitSquare, your crowdfunding campaign, and what is the best way for people to get involved if they want to help out with the project?
Sure. We have a website. It's bitsquare.io. And if you go bitsquare.io/crowdfunding, that tells you all about our Lighthouse campaign. You can just write team@bitsquare.io if you want to get in touch. And we're always looking for developers, testers. I mean, whatever your skills are, we are a very open and inclusive project, and we're really looking for as much help as we can get. I mean, we have a newsletter. Sign up for our newsletter if you just want to track our project. You can do that from the website. And yeah, we just, anybody who's interested in this, we really encourage you to get involved. We have WAN parties, we call them. So this is times when everybody can get on the BitSquare network at once and do some sort of mock trades. And yeah, that's a fun thing to do. It really kind of, I think, hopefully gives people a taste for the future.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Richard, and good luck with the Lighthouse campaign.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 10 of the P2P Connexos podcast. If you have any comments or questions, you can reach me through the contact page on my website at p2pconnex.us. Till next time.